Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of Mescal and the Coach. Greg Mescal and Adam Krikorian here with you, and we jump right in today. Tonight, it is the culmination of the men's college basketball season. The Final Four has come down to two one seeds in North Carolina and Gonzaga playing. And Coach, you have Carolina with their history, and they were just in the final last year losing to Villanova. And then in Gonzaga, four as good as they have been, having never even reached a Final Four, let alone a title game. So finally, some vindication for that program. We know both of our brackets destroyed. You had Kansas. I had UCLA. So I think we're just in this for the fun. But I know personally this is another one of my favorite sports nights. I'm just hyped in general for a good college hoops game tonight.
Absolutely. This is one of the best nights of the year. I love the fact it takes me back to Monday Night Football a lot. I love the fact it's on a Monday night for some reason, and I think both teams are kind of sentimental favorites in some ways. I mean, or just there's some sympathy with both teams. Gonzaga just being so good for so long, but never getting a chance to get there, and North Carolina losing a tough one last season and rallying back to come back and. Man, you know, I have so much respect for both programs as a young coach starting in the sport of water polo. The one program I always really loved to follow was North Carolina because I was just always so impressed with the connection between the past and the present. You never heard, for me, it just always felt like the alumni of North Carolina loved that place and loved Dean Smith. And
oh, you're definitely right. There's such an admiration for him. I think you heard the story too, right? Dean Smith willed money to all the guys who had made varsity after he passed, so they'd all go out for dinner.
Yeah, just so neat, and they're still so connected. You know, so that was just a program I loved to kind of follow and had so much respect for. And then, how do you not love Gonzaga? I mean, just such a small school and going through so much, just really kind of against the odds, but being so consistent over the course of, gosh, how long has it been now? Maybe a decade plus, probably 15 years. And I was even reading an article today about Mark Few and his assistants. They were talking about how he's inviting all of his assistants and former coaches that have been a part of that Gonzaga program in for this weekend's games, and talking about how he shared an apartment because he didn't have enough money to get by. And I'm sure a large population of the country will be rooting for them today because of that.
No doubt about it. They have so long. I mean, they've been doing this so long. You're thinking about Gonzaga. They were at a Cinderella stage at one point. Then it was almost like they were an afterthought because they've been to the tournament so many years in a row, and now it's almost kind of like come full circle and circled back to where people are pulling for them again. Because you think about all those teams they had. I mean, really, their run goes back to the Dan Monson years before Mark Few in kind of the late 90s. And then going through the 2000s, they had all these teams that just couldn't get over the top, the Adam Morrison era, and then teams in the last couple of years as well that were very talented. So, yeah, I think you're right. You have these two kind of stories that pull your heartstrings a little bit, right? In that Carolina had that brutal end last year. They got to watch a buzzer beater go down and lose in just such dramatic fashion. And then Gonzaga just knowing that they want to try and get over the top. You know, hard to say. I mean, both talented teams, both obviously loaded with future pros, two really good coaches. I like what you like and the idea that you have this iconic kind of franchise of college sports, Roy Williams, Carolina, the legacy, and then Mark Few, who's had all these chances. I'm sure that article talked about all the opportunities he had to leave, and he's never left. He's just really liked where he's been, and everything's kind of built around him. It's interesting, the idea that if you kind of stay and you dedicate yourself, in some cases it's going to work out, and all the facilities and the uniforms and everything you need will eventually show up.
Yeah, and that does. I'm going to change subjects really, really quickly. But how about Oregon? The Oregon player Jordan Bell, who, if anyone watched that semifinal game, you know, they're clawing their way back. North Carolina you know, they put him on the line to force him to make two free throws. They miss both free throws, and Jordan Bell doesn't box out. And this is a fundamental thing you learn. If anyone has ever played basketball, I think it's one of the first things you learn is how to box out. But he doesn't even put the effort in to box out. Not only one time, North Carolina gets the rebound. They foul him again. A couple more missed free throws, and he doesn't even put in the effort in again. It is almost mind-boggling. I understand kind of a lapse of concentration one time, but to do it two times in a row, it's hard to believe. And I guess, as a coach, what it kind of reminds me of is just the importance of constantly being on your athletes to do the little things, even the things that you expect them to do. You have to always remind them, and I still have a hard time kind of even grasping that. I can't believe.
No, you're exactly right. When you see a moment like that, right, you got to think what, and this is hard. I always struggle with being overly critical of the college athletes. I know how much resources they're getting, and in many ways at the higher levels, people feel like they're borderline pro athletes. But in that case, you're right. Could you get in the mind of that person and just kind of what is happening right there? To your point, I see it once, but twice, or just to not be so dialed in. I could see it going the other way, right? Where you're so intently focused on doing the job that you box the guy out and maybe you throw him across the court because you're just so amped to try and make the right play. But to be on the other end of it and almost seeming like you're not into it, that one is hard for me to wrap my mind around.
Right. Yeah, just what a crushing, and he was so emotional after.
I'm sure, crushed.
Understandably so. But it should be fun tonight.
Yeah, and that's on, you know, now the coaches, I bet, on tonight's game, you know, Gonzaga and Carolina, they can really look at those moments, and it's you're the coach here, right? Kind of use those teachable moments to kind of re-educate their guys about being in these top situations and just being ready. And talk about being ready. I know you had to have seen the highlights from not the title match of the Women's Final Four last night, but that semifinal UConn streak. We talked a lot about UConn streak, right, when we were talking USC water polo, and we'll get to them later on. But what a game. That may be the best women's basketball game I've ever watched, the UConn-Mississippi State game from a couple of days ago, and Miss State winning at the Horn.
Yeah, I mean, did anyone even watch the final? I'd be curious to know just the TV ratings difference between the championship game and that semifinal.
Sure.
Because, I mean, that semifinal, with everything that was at stake and the 111 games in a row for UConn women's basketball, I'm sure that got some high ratings and obviously garnered a lot of attention. And just, you know, to be 20-point underdogs for Mississippi State, and the woman who hit the shot at the end, just being a short guy myself, I appreciated someone that little being able to kind of weave through the defense and hit a jumper over a player that's much taller than her. Just, God, what you know, unbelievable. It says a lot about them, you know, and their belief but the other thing too that can't go unsaid is just, again, going back to UConn and just the how impressive it is, and it's a huge upset. But at the same time, most people from everyone that I've talked to or listened to would say they're shocked that UConn, after losing so many players, didn't lose one even up to that point. It was an amazing accomplishment for them. And, you know, 111 victories, I'm not sure if that's ever going to be matched again in our lifetime.
No, I mean, that is just some rarefied air that they were in. And to your point, I heard a lot of the same things, too, that from the outside, if you don't watch women's basketball closely, you assume, well, UConn rolling along, same as it ever was, they're excellent again. But this was actually a pretty impressive run for them to be on, especially in this particular 16-17 season, because they didn't have the horses, so to speak, as they'd had in previous seasons. What I really want to get your take on, though, was knowing your history coaching and having presided over some teams that have had winning streaks, you never pulled 111 in a row, that I know of, but you did have some long runs there. When that came to an end, and it wasn't a heartbreak, I don't think, of being in an NCAA tournament, correct me if I'm wrong, but how'd you process that with your group when you do finally end up losing when everyone expects you to keep winning?
I mean, are you talking, referring to a winning streak?
Correct, yes. You're on this run, you're undefeated, you know, you've won X number of games in a row, and now it's over.
Well, it's such a different world now than even it was. You know, I think USC broke our winning streak at UCLA on the women's side, and that was from maybe 2007 through 2008 and into 2009, and what was that, 7 years ago? Eight years ago?
Yeah.
And it's such a different world now because there's so much more attention to these winning streaks. I remember when that happened for us in those days, honest to God here, we did not have any idea that we had a winning streak. We had zero idea until I think it was two or three games after we had beaten the streak.
Wait, so you telling me that you won, what, 40-some games in a row and had no sense that you hadn't lost in a long time?
No, we knew we hadn't lost in a while, but we had no idea that we had beaten the streak that was set before us.
Oh, that's amazing.
So
it is. It just wasn't talked about, right? And I'm sure, knowing you, it wasn't a thing that you were bringing up. You weren't trying to hype that up.
No, we could care less. I mean, I think we found out, and I don't think we even talked about it. Maybe some of us kind of mentioned, "Oh, that's pretty cool," and and then it was on to the next thing. And some of that is, I think, the way I deal with things, and just kind of moving on. I think I've always done a pretty good job of that. But again, it largely probably has something to do with just the attention and the media and social media and how much everything is out there, which is great, you know, in a lot of ways, especially for our sport. It gives our sport a lot of attention. I mean, going back to UCLA men's winning streak for water polo that ended this past season for them, and now this winning streak for USC. I mean, it's gaining some momentum and a lot of attention for our sport, which is always something that we're looking for.
Listening here to the podcast, Meskel and the coach, Greg Meskel, Adam Krikorian here with you. Of course, NCAA hoops tonight, opening day, technically yesterday, but a lot of teams opening day today. We're going to talk about that momentarily. Want to get into some water polo talk as well. Right in the mixer, women's college water polo season. Coach, I know you were at it this past weekend doing the Arizona State-USC game, and that one ended up going in favor of USC. As we talk about winning streaks, they keep rolling along. Big splash yesterday, Stanford all over Cal. Kind of some underwhelming results there from the weekend. But I feel like we're getting into the good part here of women's water polo. We got Stanford SC coming up this weekend. We know SC UCLA is on the way. For me, it seems like, and this is no knock on Cal, but clearly we have three teams that have distanced themselves from everyone else, with Stanford, SC, and UCLA. Of course, SC undefeated. I'm guessing you don't see it differently. Hard to say who will kind of come out of this pack, but we're going to get some answers here over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and that's what I'm most excited about. I mean, I have tremendous respect for the coaching staff up at Cal, but they simply don't have the horses. You know, and they weren't deep coming into the season, and then with a couple injuries, I mean, that makes a big impact. And the three best teams have clearly been USC and Stanford and UCLA this season. And, you know, I did that USC-Arizona State game. It was competitive for a half, but then the depth and speed of USC kind of took over. And I've actually been critical of all the teams, I think, in some fashion this season, and that most of their schedules are a lot weaker than they used to be. You know, these teams aren't playing that many competitive games per year, which honestly, as a national team coach, I'm not that in favor of, because it doesn't help our athletes get better. But I'm excited. With that being said, I'm excited about these last few weeks here. I mean, USC is going to play Stanford this weekend. I believe they still have a game with Cal, and then they play UCLA to finish off. So all these teams are going to be playing each other, and we'll have a much better idea. It's easy to say USC is number one right now, and yes, of course they are, but we'll have a much better idea after these two or three weeks. And you know, Greg, you've called a few of these games, you've seen these teams. I mean, do you have a favorite going into, you know, kind of sitting as a broadcaster or a fan, anyone you think has the edge over another?
You know, you have to look at these matchups and kind of how they interact with each other, and that's why I brought up the games that are upcoming, because I'm so curious to see USC and Stanford together in a game that, not that the games prior haven't mattered if you meet in one of those preseason tournaments, but we know the value that everyone places on these conference games because of the value they have going towards the postseason. So I can get a better sense of it, you know, after we see it this Saturday, after we see SC-UCLA, after you see some of these teams get together and then move on to the conference tournament. I always tend to side with a team that has done the job and been there before. And if you think about what USC has done last year and how they brought back so many of the people on that talented group, how can you knock them until they've been knocked out by somebody else? So you know they're riding high, they're full of confidence. But the appealing thing is that you have UCLA and then you have Stanford, who we know firsthand a lot of the talent on that team and how deep they are and what they bring to the table. So I'll say two things. One, and this is not going out on any sort of a limb, right? But it's certainly a three-team race. Sure. The other thing that is a bit of a bummer is that I love the idea of more parity in college water polo, and I thought we saw a little bit of it last year. Michigan, an excellent team out of the CWPA, they're coming off a huge win over Princeton. They really pushed those teams at the NCAA tournament. They were right there in the mix. It wouldn't have been crazy if they made the NCAA final. I just don't think that's going to happen this year. I don't think we're going to, this is, you know, I don't think 2017 is the year where you're going to see someone outside of the top three push those big three. And I'm talking about SC, Stanford, UCLA. I'd love to see a change in the future. I'd love to have this conversation with you and talk about, you know, much like we do with the basketball, right? We picked two viable teams we thought would win, and they had no chance at it. And not that they had no chance, it just ended up not working out. We're just not there with women's or men's water polo, and it's a little frustrating, you know, but it's kind of where we're at, and this year it's, you know, it's going to be the teams you know well that are going to be in the mix at the end.
Yeah, and you're right. You know that what that parity does is that for the usual fan, you know, the common fan, is it creates some unknown, right? So you go into every game and you're somewhat excited and anxious to see who's going to win, and when you know who's going to win going into the game, it's really not that fun, and that's why it's going to be exciting to see the end of the season and some of these more competitive games, and hopefully one day we'll have a little bit more parity. I think everyone would want that. Even the teams that, you know, even teams that have been consistently in the top three or four would love to see that, because that just means our sport is getting better and it's growing, and there's better athletes across the board. But
no, and well, and to your point about competition, right? Wouldn't it be so much better if that of the 25 games you're going to play or whatever it might be, that if you're really challenged in those 25 games, and that if you know, and we use the basketball analogy because that's so topical right now, but you think about, say, the mid-majors in college basketball, and they purposefully schedule up, right? So if we're going to make this comparison in women's water polo, Princeton schedules up, right? They try and take on a USC for a number of reasons. Increased strength of schedule, get an opportunity against a better team, and that wasn't a game, you know, right? USC, and granted the number one team, and that does happen in other sports, but it'd be so fantastic if we could see the teams that are ranked 10 through 25, they schedule up, not just for what comes with the perks of scheduling up, but because there's a real chance that they go in there and win, stir some things up a bit, and then help their chances going forward.
Right. And just for some reason, I'm kind of flashing back to, was it Appalachian State or something like that, beating Michigan?
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, how exciting is that? I mean, I guess we can only dream.
Well, yeah, for right now, right? But it's you know, I don't know. It's one of those things that it would just be it would just be so good for the sport. And you know, we don't, and you know, you obviously as a national team coach as well. But it's like we're not picking favorites here. I always say, people ask me all the time, who do you think is going to win a game? And I say, I just really want a good game. And right. The number of games that we have, the majority of them, if we're looking at stats, the majority of them, we're talking about high-ranked teams or slow-ranked teams, they're not good games. These are lopsided affairs. So it's better for everybody. You know, we're talking over the weekend, the National League, doing all those games with John Abdo, and he talked about going to the Sloan Analytics Conference. And, you know, right. two of the hallmarks of a great game are uncertainty of outcome and then importance of the game. And in so many of these water polo matches, we only have one. We only have the importance of the game. You know, if it's a conference game or a non-conference game, and we don't always have the uncertainty of the outcome. So we live for these games like Saturday, where it's SC versus Stanford, or the NCAA final, or the MPSF tournament. And it happens in the smaller conferences too, right? Not taking anything away, the Big West is up for grabs. We don't know how the MAC's going to go, as good as Wagner has been. The CWPA, is it Princeton, Michigan? Is it Harvard? Is it someone else? So this happens, you know, we're just talking about these teams in general, but it happens all across water polo. But then all across water polo, it drops off a shelf after you get past those first couple of teams. And, you know, and the goal to create balance, create parity, I think is one that should be on everyone's kind of plate going forward.
Yeah, and that's what's exciting kind of about the Big West Conference. You know, I would say Irvine has probably had the most success, but Santa Barbara won last year.
Yep.
Hawaii, I think, has won a couple times. You know, it's and even the ones that haven't been able to break through, it's been very competitive, and that's one conference tournament that I look towards. But going to what you were saying, too, I mean, I get it all the time. People think that I have that I maybe root a certain way with games, and all I want to see is, just like you, Greg, I want to see a good game. I want to see as a coach, even as a fan, I want to see I have too much respect for the game not to just want to see it played well and played competitively. And what's actually best for my national team athletes is exactly that, a competitive game where you're kind of feeling the pressure and the intensity of a game that's going to be decided by one mistake or two mistakes or a great play or the last 4 minutes. And that's what I root for, really, every time I go to watch.
Well, no, it's so funny. I mean, we don't record that part of it, but I think every game that we do, don't we spend about 10 minutes before the game talking about how we hope it's good and how what can happen to make it good? We have that conversation before every game.
Yes, yes. We conversation and we pray to the water polo gods. It doesn't happen.
Oh, that is so true. And it's, you know what, if you're listening to this and you think that we're down on your team or that we don't like to see some school rise up, you're missing the point. It's the exact opposite. We really, and I know so many people in the water polo community want it to be like other sports, and that doesn't mean that we don't want the teams that do win to keep winning. Again, doesn't matter. So if the byproduct of it is that USC wins again, but we have a barn burner of a national championship tournament and every game you're sweating it out, great. And if they don't win and someone else does and we still get to that high energy, uncertain moment in every game, fantastic too.
Now, you had an opportunity to watch. I didn't get a chance. We had a training camp this weekend with some of our best younger athletes. And maybe that's the reason why my voice is hoarse. I haven't coached a game since August 19th.
Break out the cough drops.
August 19th. So it was a bit of a struggle, but a lot of fun. So I didn't get a chance to get over to the National League this weekend, and I'm not even sure who won. Were there competitive games? What did it look like? A lot of former Olympians, I would imagine.
Yeah, it was. You know, I think the thing with the National League, and this we heard this comment a lot over the weekend, was it's starting to pick up a little bit of steam. You know, and these things take time to build. In year three now, this was the most competitive year by far. I think you saw an added commitment. We talked a lot about this, you know, on the broadcast. And if my voice is struggling a bit, it's after calling 12 games in 2 days. which is not advisable. But all kidding aside, it was a fun time and a great scene, and you had the mixture of a lot of the up and coming athletes, the ODP national team selection camp going on in Orange County right at the same time. But what the overall kind of feeling was, larger commitment, and by that I mean some clubs went out and got some coaches that could be there on a regular basis. So you had a team like Alumni that brought in someone like Robert Lynn, who obviously knows how to coach the game and has done it at a high level, played at a high level. LA Athletic Club, new to the scene, they went out and got Brian Flax, one of the better age group and high school coaches in the country. You had all the USA teams that were well served with pipeline coaches, ones that you know well. And then you had your other club teams that that went and found dedicated people to kind of be involved. The rosters were a nice mix of names you knew, and then from the Olympic circuit and from the national teams, and then from some of the rising stars in the pipeline. And to answer your question, where it all led to was a rematch of two great clubs in the New York Athletic Club and the Olympic Club. O Club coming in, perfect record, 8-0, number one seed. They lose in the final to the New York Athletic Club. Chancellor Ramirez goes off, has four goals. Great crowd, stands full of all these rising stars in the ODP program, and then just a classic, as you have seen before, Coach, a classic New York O Club battle, physical, tie game in the third, battling, just a lot of action, and in the end, New York ends up figuring out a way. John Mann gets a goal late to kind of push him over the top, and they win it.
Yeah, I mean, those two teams always seem to kind of play. They have a great rivalry. I couldn't come up with something, but I was just trying to come up with another rivalry like that in a sport. And you can think of Duke or North Carolina, even UCLA, USC, but something in which kind of they're always competing for a championship every year after year. And the neat thing about those clubs and those teams are, these are very well, highly prestigious athletic clubs, right?
Yeah.
With thousands of members, more than likely, outside of the water polo community. So it's neat that it kind of extends beyond our little small little bubble of water polo. That's one of the things I've always enjoyed with watching the O Club and NIAC compete against each other. And I'm sure things got probably a little chippy. I've seen some of those games.
Oh, yeah.
But obviously, a huge congratulations to New York Athletic Club for winning again.
Yeah, it's just when you haven't seen that level of it since really the end of men's college season, or then the summer water polo scene with the Olympic Games and everything else last year. Fun to watch it at that level again, and to see some of the guys who are they're out of the mix a little bit. You have some guys like a Ryan Bailey who has a day job now during the week, but he's in there, posting up and still battling. He's trying to work past a Chancellor Ramirez, and then on the other end, you have a Jesse Smith and Tommy Corcoran battling. So these are just some folks that have been through kind of the battles, and they're kind of lacing it up one more time here. And I think everyone kind of benefited from that. And so we'll see where it kind of goes from here. Hopefully the momentum kind of builds some different wrinkle this year, and that now it'll kind of lead into some summer competition with two different tournaments, kind of offshoot to the National League, and then ending with a senior national event. So one kind of housekeeping note is that the two top teams from this event have earned automatic berths into the Nationals come August. So we'll try and keep that momentum going. And if you are into that scene, and Coach, I know you're a guy that loves to break down the video, all those games are available on demand on the USA Water Polo Facebook page. You can go back and watch all the streams there and check out all the fun. And while we're on it, we've got to just pause a minute. It was very weird to be at a tournament at the Woollett Aquatic Center in Irvine and not see Scott Hinman on the pool deck, and just such tragic news, his passing this past week. Well-known guy, I know someone you knew as well, coached water polo and swimming in the Irvine area for many years, was always a staple, at Woollett. You go to an event there, it's Nick Bobbitt, Scott Hinman, Scott's wife Barbie. These are the people you'd see at these events over and over again. Played a major role in the women's national team back in the 80s, in what was a very different era for that group. And I know you know too. You had some kind words for him on Twitter as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's heartbreaking when you lose someone who's just such an incredible guy. The people pass away all the time, and you always hear positive things about those who pass on, and but Scott legitimately was really one of the best dudes ever. I mean, you talk about a guy who was just, and I can't say I knew him intimately, but I've known him for a long time. And every single interaction with him, he was always so enthusiastic, so positive, so happy. Literally, I enjoyed to be around him all the time. And I can't help but to think too, kind of what he would want, and he would want us to continue to live life with that same energy and enthusiasm and passion that he had. And he had an impact on a lot of people. He had a huge impact on women's water polo in general, you know, starting with I believe coaching the UC Santa Barbara club team back maybe like early 80s, and then being a national team assistant coach in the 80s as well. And you know, he's one of those guys and one of those pioneers of our sport that believed in not just the sport but in women playing the sport and playing at a high level. And you know, one of my kind of last memories was a couple years ago. We were playing a game down in Irvine, and I was meeting with the team, and just outside of the pool, kind of pre-game, and I noticed that Scott had just kind of poked his head in, and he was standing in the back. And you know, I think maybe a lot of coaches would have been like, "Hey, what are you doing here?" But I loved the fact that he was so intrigued by what we were talking about. And I'd look over at him as I was talking to the team, and we ended up walking through a couple strategies and things that we wanted to accomplish that day. And I remember looking over and seeing him smile, and he was just loving being there. And I felt like we were kind of taking him back to those days in the 80s where he was an assistant coach. And he was always just so positive with the members of our team as well, and Barbie, his wife, as well. I mean, my heart goes out to her, who's done so much. And like you said, every event at Irvine's pool down there and at Woollett, she's there. And I'm looking forward to. I haven't heard anything about his service, but I'm certainly looking forward to paying tribute to such a great man.
Well said there, Coach. And if you've been outside the Woollett Aquatic Center, we showed some of it over the weekend on the broadcast. But great memorial tributes have popped up from the community, flowers and kind of chalk designs on the sidewalk and pictures and everything else. So that gave you another idea of just kind of the impact on the community, to say the least. So definitely someone we'll be keeping in our thoughts. And now we segue kind of towards closing things out here. Before we get to the best thing we saw on the internet, we got to talk opening day. I know one of the highlights of your life was to stand on the mound,
yes,
at the home of the San Francisco Giants and deliver, we'll call it a strike, what the heck, a 59-foot strike. Get it towards the plate, if you will. Your team starting things off, you know, I'm a Mets supporter. You're fired up for the season. What's your state of mind, what's your head out here as baseball begins?
Yes, I'm fired. Opening day is one of my favorite days. I to our training yesterday, I always wear my San Francisco Giants jersey every opening day. And I think all the athletes were looking at me a little crazy when I walked on the pool deck at 6:30 in the morning with my Giants jersey. But I just love the day. It's our national pastime. I love the sport of baseball, and bummed to see the Giants lose. Excited to see Mad Bum hit two dongs for a pitcher. And this guy, we need to start it now. It's going to start with our podcast. We need to get this guy in the home run derby.
I love the idea.
Awesome to see him, a pitcher, and he just doesn't give a blank about what anyone thinks. He's just up there smacking away. But bummed to see the Giants lose, even more bummed to watch them blow a lead like they did plenty of times last season. So not a good sign for the Giants. And I know my one pitch outing in the major leagues didn't go too well, but I still think there might be room for me on the roster if Coach Bochy decides so.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye out for the waiver wire to see if you get the nod to join the San Francisco Giants. The New York Metropolitans, they were starting today. That game is underway right now, so still in progress. Noah Syndergaard was going for the Mets, and they're an interesting group this year. They essentially just kept almost the entire team from last year together, minus Bartolo Colon, who left to go to the Braves. Somehow he's at 40 years old plus and still getting large free agent contracts, so good for him. But they're just keeping the band back together. They have a lot of good young pitching, and if you've been a Mets fan for a long time, you always just enter the season almost like you're opening a door that you don't know what's behind it. So you're just going to kind of slowly open it and kind of peek around and, you know, hope that nothing bad is back there. Yeah. That's kind of how we're treating the season once again this year. And got a chance to do a little spring training action. Saw the squad as they were getting ready for the year down in Florida. And I don't know. Just kind of see how it goes. You know, I really don't put a lot more thought into it than that, because then you... as Mets history will tell you, you tend to get your heart broken. Best to just kind of let it start, and then kind of check back in a couple of weeks and months.
Well, you gotta love baseball. Just thinking, you know, water polo is the direct opposite of this. A guy like Bartolo Colon, who can be in his 40s,
yes,
I wouldn't say he's in the best shape possible for a large man who can still somehow play baseball. I mean, it's like. I think it gives some hope for all of us 40-somethings out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the appeal of the game, too. There's a bit of the everyman vibe. There are obviously players that are in tremendous physical shape, but then you get a look of a Colon every now and again, and that's when you're on the couch one day thinking, all right, I can relate to that guy. You know, I understand skipping the gym once or twice during the week. we will now move on to how we close out our show every episode, best thing we saw on the internet, and I actually just saw it today before we started recording. The Patriots being recognized at Fenway Park, obviously coming off the Super Bowl, and this long national nightmare. They've tracked down Tom Brady's jersey that a fraudulent journalist had stolen. They got it back, but you got to love Rob Gronkowski. I mean, he's just kind of the kid in all of us. Brady's holding up the jersey. And I see this on Twitter, and Gronkowski just grabs it out of his hand and takes off running around the outfield until Brady tackles him into the ground. This is Gronkowski, who was in the ring at WrestleMania last night.
Does he really tackle him?
I mean, like not brutal, not like a, you know, like not a form tackle, but he gets him down. But Gronkowski was down in Florida last night in the ring at WrestleMania. He like shoulder blocked some guy out of the ring. And now the next day he's at Fenway and he's stealing the jersey back. It just, that guy, I mean, you know, hate him or love him, I just give him credit. He's just doing him and loving life.
Oh, that's so great. It's so great. I gotta go check that out. I'm a little torn. I got a couple things here. One is actually probably a bigger issue, maybe for another time, but an article I read and a little brief. Synopsis of just the amount of women's coaches on the collegiate level.
Okay, yeah.
How much it's decreased, but I think that's another time. I'm going to take it back to water polo, actually, and I read a quote yesterday, or I think maybe actually it was this morning, when I was trying to read up a little bit on National League, and I believe you tweeted this out, and I wrote a quote from a young player by the last name is Hurst.
Oh, yes. Ryan Hurst, yeah, trying to guard Bailey.
Yes, when guarding the four-time Olympian Ryan Bailey, who I think I played against. and his quote was, I knew I just had to try to out-muscle him, as ridiculous as that sounds. I was like, I'm going to try to out-muscle him and see how long he could go. I love this part. I knew I could definitely go longer, just based off the shape I'm in right now. So I just went at him as hard as I could. And, of course, as soon as I saw that, guess what I did, Greg?
What'd you do?
I texted Ryan Bailey. And my quote, and initially my response was, "Dude, heard this guy just dominated you." And I put the quote out there. Obviously, I know Ryan fairly well, so I know it would get a rise out of him, and of course it did, and I was successful. But I love this guy. Just, what you're talking about. I mean, how big is Ryan? 6'5"?
At least,
I don't know, 250? He may be 280 now, Ryan. But pretty funny little incident there.
yeah, I just love that quote just because it was just like the mind of this Ryan Hurst, a younger athlete in high school, but just kind of the mind of like going in there and like, yeah, it's crazy, what I'm thinking, but this is my strategy. He kind of just walked you through his whole thought process, which I thought was funny.
Yeah, hilarious, right? And that's exactly what you want to do against some of these older players. You can't back down. You got to be physical, and you got to try to wear him down. He says he could last longer because of the shape that he was in. I'm sure he was referencing the shape that Ryan Bailey is in this as well. Good for Mr. Hurst there.
Excellent stuff. That's the best stuff we saw on the internet this week. That'll wrap things up for this episode. For Adam McCoy and Greg Meskell, thanks for joining us. I'm Meskell and the coach. Best of luck in your brackets the rest of the way. One more game to play tonight, and we will talk to you next time.